Last week on the Zed Files, I covered the beginning of the Atlantic slave trade and its appearance around the globe. And I will start today's episode with a brief recap of that before proceeding with part two. The Atlantic slave trade began in the late 15th century because European settlers in the Americas didn't have enough people to work and cultivate the new land. So they devised a system in which they traded guns, alcohol, textiles, etc., with African merchants and kings in exchange for African citizens, which would then be enslaved and sold in the Americas. Slowly, the competition for trade with the Europeans began to provoke conflict between African nations, causing an epidemic of war and a depletion of men in good health, creating an atmosphere of fear. For the men who were traded, about 20% would die before they even made it to the Americas. The boat trips across the Atlantic would house 400 people at most. They were packed in so tight that they had an average of 4 square feet of space to themselves. This also made sanitation horrible, and there were constant disease outbreaks. The women would be kept above deck and sexually assaulted, and the men would be made to dance for the crew, to entertain them. 48% of the enslaved individuals went to the Caribbean, 41% went to Brazil, and 5 went to North America. Enslaved people in Brazil had an average life expectancy of 23, and frequently worked tirelessly on plantations. They are known to have endured some of the worst conditions for slaves during the Atlantic slave trade. North America had the smallest number of imported slaves, but this was because the conditions were just barely good enough for the slaves to have children. This meant that they had a self-sustaining slave population. However, the quote, masters would steal and sell their children under the belief that slavery was a hereditary status, and therefore, if the kids were born to slaves, they were slaves. Last week, I introduced the two main ideals that constructed the Atlantic slave trade and allowed the system to prosper for so long. Those ideas were, firstly, slavery was a result of human wrongdoing. So these slaves were lesser. They were not people in the same way that their enslavers were. And number two, it was a hereditary status, meaning that if you were born to slaves, you were born a slave yourself. It took many, many years for the Atlantic slave trade to truly cease to exist. But across the world, that process began in the early 1800s. However, it takes time, and we don't see the last slave ship reach American soils until the 1860s. But the end of the slave trade most certainly did not mean the end of racism. Okay, so before I start, I just want to set expectations for this episode. I tried to be more inclusive of different continents and countries in the episode last week because I realized that up until now, every episode of this podcast has been very United States-centric, which is not ideal, and I'm gonna steer away from that in the coming episodes, but for this one, it's gonna be pretty heavy on the United States talk because the end of the slave trade is just a completely different story in the US than it is in Europe. And, you know, I don't need to tell anyone how integrated slavery is in American history. It's not like I will only talk about them. I will do my best to cover as much as I can. However, I do need to devote more time to the US. But don't get me twisted. This isn't me saying that the effects are worse in the US or that we don't feel the effects in Canada. We do. We feel the effects all over the world. You can live in Sweden and you won't be exempt from exposure to racist ideologies. But with that being said, the importance of slavery in American history is just not the same as it is everywhere else. But, you know, if you're tired of hearing about the US, I feel you, and I am sorry. So, just a reminder, this episode is going to cover the second half of the Atlantic slave trade. If you have not heard my episode on the first half, you know, feel free to proceed with this episode, but you might want to go and listen to that one first. But today we're going to get into the end of the slave trade and the lasting effects of it on our global socio-political order. Okay, let us start with the end. There's a lot of things that I could discuss in reference to the end of Atlantic slavery, like all the triggers and penultimate events, but I can't get into all of them. However, one example is the American Revolution, which is obviously a whole podcast in itself, but the point is that that's one of the earlier examples of the reaction to the idea of ending slavery. Which is to say, not good. So if you can imagine, it's the late 1700s, and now we're starting to see some real skepticism around the ethics of this system. And this isn't to say there weren't abolitionists before, but we're seeing a rise in the ideologies amongst the Europeans, and people are starting to push against it a bit more. Which is, besides tea, one of the triggers for the American Revolution. The talks of abolishing, or if not that radical, reworking the system was a lot less popular amongst Americans than it was against the British. But this isn't about the American Revolution, and there were many other places besides America that needed to support the end of the slave trade for it to be effective. Examples are Portugal, Spain, Holland. The first of the two key ideologies that I keep bringing up, that the slaves are criminals or somehow lesser, is starting to erode. Because people are beginning to grow suspicious. If you think about it, these 18th and 19th century slave owners are disconnected from the West African coast much more than the early settlers in the 15th century were. So the idea that they're criminals starts to feel a little forced. But sadly, this doesn't mean that they realize the error of their ways and move on. No, they just need to find a new thing to use as justification. So, the whole idea of racial inferiority is constructed for that purpose. I would assume you know that race does not exist. There is no common gene between white people versus black people that makes one superior to the other. But this idea that there was becomes the new justification for slavery. Another contributing factor is that because many European countries had outlawed enslavement of fellow Christians, and because many Europeans preached a universal religion, they needed to find a reason to act against those beliefs. I'm going to get into this more later in the podcast, but for now, just understand that the justification for slavery has shifted, and it's no longer that the criminals are slaves. It's black people that are slaves. However, let's jump forward to 1807, on March 2nd, and we start to actually see some progress. Now, let me tell you, people were attached to their slaves and the idea of slavery, especially in the American South, so it wasn't a fast process. But in the United States, it officially began on March 2nd of 1807, when the American Congress passes an act to prohibit the importation of slaves into any port or place within the jurisdiction of the United States from any foreign kingdom, place, or country. So let's break that down. Slavery as a practice is not prohibited, however, importing slaves into America is made illegal. And prior to the Americans, this ban had already been enacted in Britain earlier that year. However, in 1807 America, there was a strong, self-sustaining slave population of over 4 million people. So it wasn't like stopping the importation of slaves was really limiting slave owners. Everyone who still owned slaves was still under the law able to. And since the population was self-sustaining, and we know from last week's episode that only 5% of the total population of enslaved Africans went to North America, this ban didn't really have a huge effect on slave owners, considering that they were already selling and trading internally more than with foreign ships. However, this act went into effect on January 1st of 1808, and even though it didn't accomplish much, it was a step in the right direction. In 1820, this was updated, and importing slaves was declared piracy, a crime punishable by death. This is the first step for America. However, we know it wasn't actually abolished until the Civil War, in the 1860s. And before then, most European countries will abolish it. Spain being the first. They fully abolished slavery in 1811, including in all its colonies. However, Cuba rejects this ban, and proceeds to practice and deal in slaves. In 1813, Sweden banned slave trading, which is, remember, different from abolishing slavery. The Netherlands do the same thing in 1814. In 1817, France bans slave trading, although the ban does not go into effect until 1826. And then, in 1833, slavery is abolished in all British territories, so this means Canada as well. And as a Canadian who knows other Canadians, I think we seem to have a sense of pride around the fact that it was abolished here 30 years before it was in America. And that's true. But I want to explain what that actually looked like, because it might change your mind a little bit. The British government spent £20 million of taxpayer dollars, which was 40% of its budget in 1833, to buy the slaves' freedom. £20 million is equivalent to £20 billion today. which makes this one of the largest ever government bailouts, a cost so high the loans the government took weren't paid out until 2015. But here's the bad news. This money was not going to the slaves, it was going to their enslavers. So taxpayers, all the way up until 2015, were paying off the debts the government was in order to compensate British slave owners. But it gets worse, because the slaves that were, quote, freed, were actually committed to 6 to 12 more years of service as unpaid apprentices. Meaning slave owners were being compensated for millions of dollars and yet still continuing to get free labor. It wasn't until 1838 that the apprenticeships were abolished as well, and slaves in the British Empire were finally fully emancipated. So although it was a positive thing that the British abolished slavery in 1833, don't lose sight of the full story. After this, the rest of Europe starts to fall in line, with the Danish following suit in 1846, France in 1848, Portugal in 1858, the Netherlands in 1861. In Cuba, it was abolished in 1886, and in Brazil, 1888. I'm listing all the major nations that banned it so you get a sense of how many places were practicing it. You probably have a general sense of when it was abolished in the United States. President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862, and it went into effect on January 1st of 1863. And with the amendment of the Constitution in 1865, slavery was officially banned. However, in the time between the ban on slave trading in 1820 and Abraham Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation, slave trading went on underground. And it's estimated that within this time, slavers brought in around 8,000 captives in the decade following the ban. At the time, the global demand for sugar, coffee, and cotton was growing enormously. And so this meant Americans needed laborers to work the land and produce these goods. This meant that traffickers had a large incentive to break the law and continue with the slave trade, especially since the demand was so high that profits raised by 90%. The illegal slave ships were able to do this via the Middle Passage. The culmination of this process took place in New York, and New York became internationally notorious for its underground network of slave trading. A British newspaper published at the time that New York was, quote, the greatest slave mart in the world. In the 1850s, a famous group of slave traders named the Portuguese Company set up shop in New York City, and they would work with the Americans to get their ships on the way to Africa, pretending the voyages were legal. Interestingly, though, by the end of the 1850s, almost all slavers were Americans. The last ship to ever arrive in the United States was named the Clotilda, and it contained a young Yoruba man named Aluole Kasola. However, in America, he was renamed Cudjoe Lewis. Shortly before his death, in 1935, he gave a series of interviews to anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston, where he spoke on the trauma of being captured, sold, and shipped to a foreign place, and his experience doing labor work and being held captive. There are many important things that happened in the years preceding slavery. You've likely heard of many of them. For example, the initiative North American governments took to send African Americans back to Africa, regardless of the fact that by this point, most were born in America and had never been to Africa in their life. These are all important things for us to understand, so I would encourage you to do the research yourself, as at this point, I don't have enough knowledge to adequately discuss these events in detail. So I'm going to move on to part 4. As I think that I've provided a strong timeline of the abolition of slavery around the world, we are going to now take a look at the lasting effects on the world's socio-political order, which is to say, I'll discuss the economic/socio-economic impact of the slave trade around the world, 150 years later. This is probably the most important section out of all of them. Slavery has quite literally shaped our modern economies. It is what allowed Western countries, such as America, to become global superpowers, but is also what left West Africa vulnerable and open to conquest and colonization. It is the root of our current most prominent societal hierarchy, race, a system that white people unconsciously or even consciously benefit from every single day. So it's really important to discuss this, regardless of your race. Personally, I think we should get to a place where we can see the Atlantic slave trade not as a piece of history that has come and gone, but as something that has evolved over time to fit into our ever-changing societal standards and expectations. In recognizing and acknowledging this, we are educating ourselves on the roots of white supremacy, and that knowledge will hopefully help us to work to dismantle it. Because, as it has been said time and time again, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. Human beings have yet to be successful in creating a society that is fully equal. No matter what time period or location, we separate and generalize and chastise people simply because they are different. But the thing is that throughout most of history, that simple difference that made us see someone as inherently lesser rarely came from the color of their skin. In ancient Rome, they didn't care what the color of your skin was, or your eyes, or your hair. They only cared if you were Roman. And if you weren't, well, they still didn't care what you looked like. And this isn't to say that that is a better mentality to have. Oppression in any form is not okay. I'm more trying to make the point that oppression, taking on a racial bias, is a relatively modern concept. And it's tied directly to Atlantic slavery. You've probably heard the phrase, race is a social construct. But that's confusing, I know. So my understanding of it, which may not be correct, and I encourage you to draw your own conclusions, is that it means that we made it up, and we all believe in it, which is what allows it to continue to exist. But here's the thing, race does not exist. It was an idea that somebody, or a couple somebodies, came up with to justify the enslavement of West Africans. And we can give those somebodies who had the idea a name and a face. For example, Thomas Jefferson. I'm sorry to bring these up again, but the first of the two key concepts that Atlantic slavery is built on the backs of is that these slaves are lesser than their, quote, owners. That they are criminals and they deserve it. But as I explained earlier, as the slave owners became more disconnected from the African coast, and the people being sold were no longer criminals in the usual sense, if you remember from last week's episode, the thing that made them lesser became the color of their skin. And this wasn't unconscious, this was a choice. People fabricated biological differences between the races to make the argument that they were somehow destined to be slaves. I think we have this notion that over time we get smarter, that we evolve and our neurons get faster or our brains get bigger. But I have this feeling that you have a belief in your mind that the slave owners were not as smart as you, and that's why they thought it was okay to buy and sell human beings like property. In reality, we have no evidence to suggest that our ancestors were any less neurologically developed than us. So a person, likely with the same or very similar, if not more, intellectual abilities than you, made these decisions and then chose to make it about the color of their skin. So try not to see your ancestors that way, because when we do, we exonerate them and, by extension, ourselves. Anyway, I've gotten kind of off topic, so I want to wrap up what I've said over the past few minutes. My point is that racism is not natural, we made it up. And we made it up because of the Atlantic slave trade. This event was so impactful that it determined the socioeconomic divides between generations of white and black people. It created a social justice hierarchy so powerful that over 150 years later, we are still fighting every day to dismantle it. Okay, I'm gonna pivot quickly now and look at some of the lasting effects that it had in Africa specifically. Like I hope I've made clear by now, West African economies very heavily relied on the trading with the Europeans. So when slavery was slowly outlawed and banned, many of these economies collapsed because they lost their main source of economic growth. Most of their male population was gone and many young women were gone as well, which made repopulation difficult. And many nations were at war, which only further propelled the economic downslide. And all of this just made West Africa a perfect target for European colonization, and in turn set the stage for the economic instability we see in many African countries today. The reason that many West African countries are not as economically stable and not as wealthy and prosperous in the same way that Western countries are is all tied to Atlantic slavery. And at the exact same time, the reason that Western and European and prominently white countries are known for the opposite is also a direct consequence of this. They feed off each other. My point is, and I hope I've made it, although I've gone a bit off topic, is our current socio-political order is entirely the way it is because of Atlantic slavery. It quite literally shaped the way we see the world. It shaped global economies. It was and is so influential that it is almost hard to comprehend. Something I often found myself wondering in writing and doing research on the Atlantic slave trade is why I never really learned that much about it in school, and why at the same time I was bombarded with Holocaust education. And you know I'm not saying that we shouldn't be educated on the Holocaust, we most certainly should be. I just found myself wondering why one was treated as more important than the other, because if you think about it, they're pretty similar, except one lasted 5 years and the other a couple hundred. I've concluded that the reason for this is because the Holocaust makes Canada and America and Western and European countries look great, and Atlantic slavery does not, which is, I think, systemic racism and white supremacy in action. I've done my best over the past 2 weeks to speak on the events and impact of the Atlantic slave trade as respectfully as possible, but with all that being said, I am still a teenage white girl, and I have a lot to learn. And so I would appreciate any feedback on how to speak respectfully on the issues of race, and any criticism of how I did so in this and past episodes. Overall, learning about the Atlantic slave trade has shifted my worldview. I used to think I had an understanding of racism and what race meant, but it is so much deeper and so much more complex than I could have imagined. However, this is only the beginning, and it goes so much deeper. So I will continue to educate myself on race, not only in history, but in our current society, since our school system does not do so. And, you know, I strongly encourage you to do the same. In terms of my sources for this podcast, I used quite a few, as usual. Similar to the Ida B. Wells episode, a wonderful TED-Ed video is what made me want to write about the Atlantic slave trade. I'm also very appreciative of the wonderful Hank and John Green at Crash Course History because that video provided me with so much important information and I found it all so valuable in writing this. If you are more interested in educating yourself further on the issues of race today, specifically race in America, I would recommend the book So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijoma Oluo. It's a really great place to start, as it covers some of the major concepts like microaggressions and the school-to-prison pipeline. I found it very informative, but also digestible. Like, I didn't feel in over my head. So, I would recommend it. However, my biggest piece of advice is listen to Black people, not me. But, thanks for listening anyway. I really appreciate it, and I hope you enjoyed it. I did find these episodes a little more difficult to write because of how heavy the subject matter is, but I hope I was able to do justice to that and that you enjoyed it. So anyway, thank you so much for listening both to this week and hopefully last week's as well. It means a lot. Thank you.